Welcome to Unlikable Female Characters, the podcast featuring feminist thriller writers in conversation about women who don't give a damn if you like them. I'm Lane Fargo, and I'm here with Kristen LaBianca.
Hello.
And we are also joined today by Amanda Jayatissa. Amanda grew up in Sri Lanka, completed her undergrad at Mills College, California, and lived in the UK before moving back to her sunny little island. She works as a corporate trainer, owns a chain of cookie stores, and is a proud dog mom to her two spoiled huskies. My Sweet Girl is her debut thriller. It's out now from Berkeley. It's actually out the day that we're recording this. So welcome, Amanda, and also happy book birthday.
Yes, happy book birthday.
Thank you so much, Lane and Kristen. Thank you for having me. It's so exciting for me to be here.
Yeah, we're thrilled to talk to you. We love this book. It's so much fun. It is going to be a little hard to talk about without spoiling it. It's so twisty. Like, there's so many things, but we will do our best. And if we accidentally do some spoilers, I'll cut them out. I promise. Do you want to tell us a little bit about My Sweet Girl?
Sure. So My Sweet Girl is about a woman who finds her blackmailing roommate dead in their San Francisco apartment. But when the police arrive, they can't find any trace of the body or any evidence that the roommate even existed to begin with. Paloma, that's the name of our main character. She is convinced that all of this is somehow tied into her childhood in Sri Lanka and the decisions that she made to escape the orphanage where she grew up.
Awesome. Yeah, that's so much like the plot about the roommate blackmailing her and disappearing and all this stuff. Like, that is the whole plot of a lot of other thrillers, right?
Just the setup here. Yeah,
that's just the setup. It's just like the first few chapters, and mm-hmm. then it goes like on a very wild ride from there. So yeah, this book was incredible. I could not put it down.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah, it's very hard for me to give like too much of a synopsis without ruining things.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what was the inspiration behind this book? Like, how did you come up with the original idea, and like, how did it develop?
Great question. So I was initially working on a completely different book, but when I tend to approach a story that I'm writing, I tend to approach it with this mentality, like plot twist or big reveal first. That is always the first idea that I have. But I was working on this book and I had this plot twist in mind, but the book wasn't working. It just, the characters weren't coming together right. The story wasn't gelling. I was just trudging my way through it and very, very, very deeply unhappy. And then my frustration hit its peak, interestingly, at a very unfortunate encounter with my bank. It was one of those terrible incidents where, you could swear they're getting it wrong, and it was very frustrating, and I was seething inside and so angry, but I had to put on this mask, this face where I was smiling and pleasant and thanking them, even though, you know, they've totally bungled up my paperwork, and it was took about an hour of my time, and I was really, really annoyed and irritated. After this, I escaped to my favorite cafe and I ordered the largest cup of coffee that I could, you know, get my hands on. and, you know, I mean, everything is better once you're caffeinated, right?
And yes.
So after I was, you know, I drank this whole cup of coffee, I was feeling a lot better. And I pulled out, you know, my notebook and a pen, and I started sort of rage writing. I was writing all these really angry, mean thoughts that, you know, I was thinking it, but I was not wanting to say it out loud. And it's just this dam broke somehow. And I was just rage writing. And, you know, I was letting myself think these uncharitable thoughts that I think as women, especially, we're conditioned not to think, we're conditioned not to say them. And while I was doing that, I realized I was having so much fun. And I thought, you know what, I want to see if I can tie this into a character somehow, a character that can really give a voice to some of the frustrations that we feel as women, that I have felt as a brown woman navigating, you know, white spaces. It's like, how can I take all of this and put it into this character? And that's sort of where Paloma was born. And then I took that story that I was working on and I gutted it out completely and just took out like the bones of like the plot twist and the elements that I liked. And I wove it into this other story in this background in San Francisco. where I had spent quite a bit of time myself. And yeah, it seemed to work. So that's how My Sweet Girl came about. It really started with Paloma.
Yeah, I love that. And rage writing is the best kind of writing. I think we all agree here, right, Kristen?
Yes, it's like one of the best parts of being a crime writer is the ability to punish people that you can't punish in real life. So
to write down all the things you can't say out loud. Yeah, yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, of course. My best friend got me this mug today as a publication day present. And it says, please don't annoy the writer. She may put you in a book and kill you. And that is so true.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah, Paloma has such a strong voice and like is so much fun to read. Like the meaner she is, the more I'm like just loving it, kind of like laughing along with everything. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she is completely unfiltered and I love it.
I love writing
in her head anyway.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I loved about writing her is that it was fun to give myself permission to get as angry as I liked. Which I have always felt that I couldn't be, right? And I don't. And it's very funny because a lot of people come and ask me, they're like, oh, are you Paloma? Do you have a lot of pent-up rage inside of you? You know, one of my friends actually, and a very early reader of the book, he called me up afterwards and he said, you know what, I know what to get you for your birthday. I'm going to get you a piñata. And I was like, what? Why? He's like, you sound like you just need to beat something up really badly. I was like writing Paloma was the only release I needed. I didn't need to beat anyone. But yeah, it was really fun to give myself permission to think in a way that I've been taught not to. So for me, that was why I really enjoyed writing her story.
And I think that, you know, characters often get labeled with that unlikable label, mm-hmm. when they do things that are outside of what we as a society generally deem as acceptable behavior. So it's mm-hmm. like, you know, even if she's not being unkind to someone's face, like mm-hmm. she is thinking in a way that is going to get her labeled as unlikable. And it's like, it's kind of ironic because the more unlikable characters are, the more we love them here.
Here, yes. But it's like, if anybody's internal monologue was like written down or recorded or made public, like we're all jerks, I think.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
everyone
for
has
sure.
Oh, charitable.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
100%. I'm like, I'm glad no one has, you know, front row seats to what goes on in my head. Like it's a party in that. Yeah. No one needs to see that.
I think another interesting thing about Paloma is how she really kind of weaponizes people's expectations of her, right? Like mm-hmm. she is an immigrant and she's an orphan. She's a brown woman. She's like all these things that like these white spaces that she's moving in, people have certain expectations of who she is and how she should behave. Mm-hmm. And she is incredibly aware of that and uses it to manipulate people. I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit. I found that so fascinating.
Sure. And I think that's one of the things that really came out almost like unconsciously. It wasn't something that I thought about too much when I was writing, but as you know, it kind of took on this voice of her own, or the character took on a voice of its own. It's something that kind of developed over time because I started sort of thinking like, why shouldn't she? Right? She's been,
yeah.
You know, she's been dealt this hand and it's not all bad. And she's very good at recognizing what could work to her advantage and what couldn't. And the things that sometimes worked to her advantage were these terrible stereotypes that she was fed up of. But hey, like she recognizes that she could use this and, you know, something that's been disadvantageous to her perhaps her whole life or something that's been viewed for her as almost this thorn in her side. She can now use this to get what she wants. And that's a really cool thing about her. It is quite manipulative. And she knows what she's doing. But I think mm-hmm. she's also real enough to acknowledge that I think everyone does that to some degree, right? Like we're all dealt a hand and we're all playing with the cards that we have. And she's like, why shouldn't I? You know, how many times do people use certain privileges that they have, you know, that they were just, you know, given at birth, like just by luck of birth, they've got certain privileges. And how many times do people weaponize those all the time, right? So why shouldn't she? Why is it wrong when a brown woman does it as opposed to like a white man?
Yeah, I don't think it's wrong at all. I mean, the only reason she's able to manipulate people in this way is because of these stereotypes and expectations mm-hmm. that they have. Like if they would just see her as a full person and like get to know her and everything, she wouldn't be able to manipulate them like that. But she, you know, they see her in this certain way and she sees that and uses it against them. Like that's serves them right, honestly.
Yeah, I really like that. And then another sort of aspect of her that I really loved was the way the dynamic changes when she meets Sam in the story, because he's someone obviously who manages to draw her mind back to her past where she was a different person, right? So when she lived in Sri Lanka and, you know, when she was growing up in the orphanage, she spent her youth, obviously her mind wasn't working in the way that it's working when she's an adult. So it sort of, you know, calls her back to that. And you can see almost this softness come out with a sense of nostalgia. And I really liked adding that extra dimension to her. That was a lot of fun. It was also fun to bring in these Sri Lankan elements with this adult Sam, you know, and the way he was speaking and bringing in those Sri Lankan elements was a lot of fun as well.
Yeah, and her resistance to it and kind of like internally making fun of him for these things that she recognizes as Sri Lankan. And yeah, that was so interesting, the dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah, and I was really nervous when writing it because I mean Sam's one of my favorite characters, but at the same time I was very nervous about writing about their interactions because I didn't want it to seem cheesy, but it was cheesy because Sam is cheesy and Paloma
in the best way.
yeah I mean Sam was he was a favorite character of mine to develop, so it was it was so much fun, and I was like, okay, how cheesy can I make him without, you know, making him a total caricature? But it was a wild ride.
I think in thrillers too, when you have a character like that who's kind of cheesy and sweet, it's so like suspicious to readers who are used to reading thrillers. You're just immediately like, what is this guy's game? Like, he can't be this nice. I don't know. You use that to really good effect as well.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. And I mean, I'm not gonna say too much, obviously, but
no.
But yeah. And that in itself is why I love the genre. It's why I love reading thrillers, is why I love thriller readers, is that whenever we see somebody nice, immediately it's like warning bells go off in your mind. You're like,
yes,
no, he can't be that nice. Oh, something's not right here, you know. So there's always that element.
Yeah, we're always questioning the motives of like literally everyone. Mm-hmm. On the page and in life sometimes, honestly.
Yeah, I was reading one of my friend's cozy mysteries. Her name is Olivia Black. She wrote this awesome cozy called Killer Content. And in that, there's one character that shows up, you know, and she's being really nice and she cooks the main character dinner. And it was so funny because we have a little group and all the thriller writers in the group were like, oh, that lady, she's so suspicious. Something's wrong. Like, why would you just show up and do something nice for someone? That makes no sense.
But like in a cozy, there are like nice people in cozies. You can't suspect every nice person in a cozy.
Sure. It throws me off. That's what it does. These cozies are too many nice people.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I read Mia Manansala's book, Arsenic and Adobo, and I definitely, like, coming from reading mostly thrillers, I was so suspicious of everyone, and many of the characters were just, like, sweet, lovely people. I felt bad. Yeah.
What is it about thrillers that made you want to write thrillers?
Oh, great question. I've always loved books that had some sort of element of mystery to them. I think that's because, so growing up in Sri Lanka, I had very limited access to books outside of, I guess, sort of the classics. But one type of book that I did have a lot of access to was like Famous Five and Secret Seven and, you know, those Enid Blyton books. And so I ended up reading quite a lot of especially Famous Five books, I think, growing up. And that introduced me to this idea, or I think just this idea of loving mystery sort of took root there. And then as I got older, I've obviously liked books with creepier elements to them, you know, started off with, kind of reading a lot of R.L. Stine when I was younger, then going on to Stephen King, which I still love, and then Shirley Jackson, which like blew my mind. And then I think everything kind of got turned around and spun on its head when I read Gone Girl. Because I think that was that first book that I read with this sort of this unlikable female character who was just, oh, she was so mesmerizing. And I remember reading it and it was like 3 a.m. and I got to that, you know, like that twist, and I just sat up in bed and shouted like, you gotta be like, well, it was a very colorful language. I'm not going to say it all here, but you know, I was like, oh God, you know, you got to be kidding me. You woke up my poor husband who was so confused. And and I think that's what really sparked this love of thrillers, but not just your standard thrillers that center women who have this like almost edge to them. Right. And I mean, it went on. I've read everything that Gillian Flynn has written, you know, Girl on the Train after that, and just so on. Like Jessica Knowles, Luckiest Girl Alive, books like that, where you have these female characters, female main characters, and they're not your typical women that you've sort of been conditioned to envision as your heroine in a book. That's what I loved.
Gillian Flynn is like the origin story for so many of us. Like Gone Girl was totally formative for me too. Mm-hmm. I wrote like a completely different kind of book as my first book, which we'll never see the light of day. It was like dystopian or something.
Right.
And then I read Gone Girl and it just changed my life.
Yeah, it does. It does. She really is sort of, Gillian Flynn is like, she gave birth to, I think, like the thrillers with these female voices the way we know them today. I think she's just fantastic. I'm just such a big fangirl. It's ridiculous.
She's awesome. Yeah, I met her once when I was like a little baby writer. Oh, wow. And I was completely tongue-tied and like a total dork. Like I just so amazing. Yeah. Oh my God.
That would be me. I mean, if I were ever that lucky, that would totally be me. I'll just stand there with like my jaw hanging to the floor or something. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk, we've talked about Palomo a little bit, but I also wanted to talk about another character in this who is, I think, quote unquote, unlikable in a completely different way, which is Paloma's adoptive mom, Elizabeth Evans, mm-hmm. who we see mostly in the like flashback chapters, but she's a big presence in Paloma's adult life as well. And she's this, well, why don't you tell us about her? She seems like too perfect, right?
Well, to young Paloma, she is perfect. And that is sort of the point. And I think when you're, especially when you're young, and even to older Paloma, I think it's very interesting. And I had a very interesting time writing Mrs. Evans, because Mrs. Evans is, I think, a big culmination of a lot of older women that I have met in my life who are very well-meaning and have the best of intentions. But their execution is a little questionable, right? And it's not necessarily their fault. I always go back to sort of the time that I spent in the Bay Area and where I came across a lot of people who were, I think, similar to her, who had these great intentions and you know, viewed, say, different cultures with a sort of reverence, but up to a certain point, as long as it was comfortable to them. And then after a certain line was crossed, they were like, okay, no, I can handle these parts of your culture, but I can't handle the rest. And at the time, especially when I was there, this term of like microaggressions, those things are not were not things that I knew. We weren't privy to that kind of language at the time. Right, these are new terms that we're now only now starting to wrap our heads around, I think, and understand. But I remember when I was in the Bay Area being told certain things and sort of laughing it off, but not feeling very happy inside, feeling kind of upset or feeling a little bit icky, and not really being able to put my finger on it, right? I'm like, okay, I'm just going to laugh along with everyone, or I'm just going to smile and act like everything is fine because that's what's expected of me. And that's sort of what happened to channel its way into, like, that was the energy that made its way into Mrs. Evans' character, where she definitely meant well, and she definitely had a sort of a love and appreciation up to a point for Paloma's culture and where she came from, as long as it didn't inconvenience the narrative that she had already set up for herself and her perfect sort of existence and this perfect family that she was trying to, develop for herself.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like, it's this narrative she's created that she's this like charitable, like angelic, rich woman who's going to save Paloma from her horrible childhood. Mm-hmm. And like, that's where she sees herself. And I think that's how like people in her community see her. Like she gets that award calling her the Angel of the Bay and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And she looks very angelic, but it's all just this narrative. And she's actually done a lot of harm that she's not aware of, like through her well-meaning. I thought she was interesting to see her through like all these different perspectives.
Sure. And the thing about her is that, I mean, up to a point, she did save Paloma. She did give her access to a fantastic mm-hmm. life. She did give her all the things that she was sort of, you know, that Paloma wanted growing up. But at the same time, she didn't realize the damage she was doing. It wasn't like she was this evil villain that, you know, had this master plan and she knew what she was doing. She had no idea what she was doing. And I think a lot of people don't. A lot of well-meaning men and women who donate to charities, who, try to help out in certain aspects. I don't think that they're totally aware of some of the harm they might do. So, yeah, she's not a villain. She's just someone that is not very self-aware or aware of the struggles that a woman like Paloma might face in her situation.
Yeah, and she's like never had to be like she right. is privileged and mm-hmm. white and beautiful and like all of these things. And so she's just never had to like grapple with any of that and live this sort of charmed life. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there are so many people like that. I assume a lot in San Francisco since there's a lot of wealth there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very fascinating character to see in like opposition to Paloma, even though she's not a villain, but she's kind of an antagonist in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I thought she was very fascinating. Mm-hmm.
I really like how, at the beginning of the book, something unknown to the reader has happened that has left Paloma's parents very disappointed in her. Mm-hmm. And I really like how you use the idea of like parental disappointment as a driver of suspense. I feel like that's like a very like modern way to create suspense in the narrative. Mm-hmm. I think you'd do it really well.
Oh, that's just the South Asian in me coming out. No, I mean, I joke. My parents are great, and I've never had to like worry about disappointing them or anything like that. But but it is, I think, very prevalent in South Asian culture, where you know, it is something that you have to be very much aware of when you're making certain decisions and you're doing certain things. So that was a little bit of that called on as well, because Paloma did grow up in an environment, I mean, at least until she was 12, that did, have that focus on like, listen to your elders, respect your elders. And it's very much a cultural thing that's driven into you from a very young age. So it seems only realistic that adult Paloma would manifest some of that in her life, even though her parents, I mean, her parents did get disappointed in her and they didn't want to speak to her. So, hey, I mean, then I guess they weren't so different from South Asian parents, but but I really did want to bring in that aspect too.
I was wondering if you might want to talk about kind of the process of like selling this book and working with your editor is Jen Monroe, right? Mm-hmm. At Berkeley.
Yes, that's right.
Who also edits Samantha Downing. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of like a legend in her own right. So yeah, I was just curious like how that process went, like the sale of the book and working with her and how much it changed maybe from that initial draft?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I worked on the sort of the draft that I queried with for about 11 months, a little less than a year, I think. And then I was very, very lucky to meet my absolutely fantastic agent, Melissa Danasco. She really, I think, took the story and gave me some like amazing advice that just tightened things up and made it that much stronger and better. So we spent a few months on a couple of edit rounds that made it, I think, to a great extent what it is today. And then it was really awesome because very recently Melissa sent me a photo of the list that she made up of the editors that she'd like to submit this book to after our very first phone conversation when she made me an offer. And the very first name she'd written on that list was Jen Monroe from Berkeley.
Cool.
Yeah, I know. It was so wild. Like, I couldn't believe it when I saw it. And yeah, and so we sent it out on submission. And you know, when a book goes out on submission, you have a lot of expectations, but you also try to keep your excitement reined in because you know that there's a good chance that it could take a very long time for something to happen. But I think before the week was out, Jen had emailed Melissa, my agent, and said that she really liked the book. And then, of course, like, I'd read My Lovely Wife, right? So I was like, oh my goodness, I want this to work so, so badly. And yeah, and then we hopped on a call, and I knew, I think after that first phone call, that I definitely, definitely 100% wanted to work with Jen, because she really got the story that I was trying to tell. I think what was really important for me was that she got Paloma, and she didn't want me to really censor her in any way. And she was very conscious of the fact that some of the story of some of the incidents that Paloma had to face were incidents that I've had to face. And so, you know, it was really wonderful working with her. She gave me, again, a lot of really good ideas to tighten up the story, including that final chapter, which I'm not going to talk about. but let's just say it was completely different. It took a completely different direction in an earlier version. And it was a little happier in that version too, but then we just went full dark with this one. and I love it, and honestly, because I very briefly many years ago in a very small scale self-published, this was a while back, but I absolutely loved traditional publishing because of this collaborative process. I love having, you know, an agent and an editor that I can bounce ideas off, and who give me this feedback, and have helped really in essence shape Paloma to who she is at the end. So I honestly love the process so much.
It's so awesome to like find an agent and an editor that you feel like really understands the characters that you're writing about, and they just get your story. It's just such a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. And I think especially because I have, and Paloma really is one of those lover or hater characters, right? I don't expect everybody to like her, or you know, and I have had, you know, various feedback over time saying, you know what, I think she's too abrasive, or I think she swears too much, and that is something that I have heard before. So to work with people who really understand what I was trying to get at, you know, that yes, she does use very bad language, but it's all only in her head. She never says it out loud. I think much like quite a few of us do. But to work with people who really get that, it makes such a huge difference. I'm so grateful for it.
Yeah, and someone who's not trying to censor that character, like you said, and sand her down. And because I've heard stories from other writers where they had a character who was kind of like that, and then the editor's like, oh, well, we should change this to make her more likable or more palatable to the reader. And I mean, you have to know, working with Jen, like having read My Lovely Wife and Samantha's other books, like she's not going to do that. Yeah. She's going to go all the way.
Yeah. I love that. I love that about her. It's been so wonderful.
So there's this motif in the book of Wuthering Heights I wanted to ask you about as well, Amanda. Like that when Paloma's in the orphanage, she's reading a copy of Wuthering Heights, and that's what catches the eye of Mrs. Evans and kind of convinces her to adopt Paloma. And I was just wondering if you would talk a little bit about that, because there are these parallels between Paloma and Heathcliff, I was noticing.
That's right. So it's interesting with the way I write, because I don't usually think too deeply about themes on the earlier drafts, right? There are things that I always try to tease out as the story progresses and so on. But I always knew that I wanted there to be a certain element to the adoption and a bit of a conflict surrounding a book. And I thought, hey, as a nod to my mother, who was very supportive of me as a writer, and she passed away 11 years ago, but I, her favorite book was Wuthering Heights, and she had me read it when I was 12, which was the same age as the girls in the story. And so I thought, hey, as a nod to her, let me put in Wuthering Heights. And then the more I thought about it, I was like, oh, hey, that's right. I do see these parallels. I do see things that kind of connect the two stories. And then obviously I played off that a little bit. You know, there are orphans, and there are so many orphans, right? If you look in a lot of classical literature, there are so many stories with orphans that are referenced again through the book itself. And it was just a really fun way of bringing in this story that to me at 12 played kind of this really interesting role. And then I just thought, hey, it'll be a fun sort of nod to my mom. And I put it in, and it worked. So that was how that ended up there.
Yeah, because it has all this thematic resonance. It's really interesting. I just reread Wuthering Heights recently. I hadn't read it since high school, right. I don't think. And I had completely forgotten, because I was remembering, you know, like the Ralph Fiennes movie version and everything, that Heathcliff is described in the book as not white. Like, they never specify what his race is, but a lot of the prejudice that he faces is because of his skin color, not just his social class. And that gets lost in a lot of conversations about Wuthering Heights, but it like definitely made me think of that reading this, and like Paloma's kind of relationship to the book. And I love when things like that are completely kind of like accidental, like you just put it in there as a tribute to your mom, and then it actually has all of this thematic weight and meaning.
I loved it.
You just think like your subconscious is working on that.
I think to some sense it was like, okay, I understand there's this sense of not belonging. And then I think it was sort of kind of like a midway through the book, or midway through a rewrite or a edit of the book, where I was like, let me just read Wuthering Heights again. Because I mean, like you, I don't think after your teenage years, you tend to really reread those books too often. So I hadn't read it in quite a while. And yeah, and then I remember reading it and thinking, oh goodness, there's a lot here. There's a lot to unpack. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to connect. So that was a lot of fun to do.
Well, what are you working on now?
I am working on, we're actually just doing the, I think, one of the more final rounds of edits on book two. I don't know how much I can talk about it, but I can say that it is set in Sri Lanka, but in a completely different setting to the one in My Sweet Girl. This one takes place in sort of Colombo high society, and it centers around a big Sri Lankan wedding. And again, there are two very interesting female narratives. Actually, there are quite a few narratives in the story, but the main two women were very, very different from Paloma and different from each other. And just, again, very fun to sink my teeth into and write.
That sounds awesome. I can't wait to read it. Do you know when it's going to be out? Is it like next year, or do you not have a date yet?
I was told next September. So that's a year from now.
Okay. That's pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting in publishing terms.
In publishing time.
Yeah. No, and it's so funny because I remember when my deal announcement came out, it was about a year ago. And I remember saying to my husband, I was like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to be able to wait for an entire year. That sounds like so far away. And then it just flew by and there was so much to do. And at the end, I was like, oh my goodness. Okay, I understand now why they say, you know, it takes like a year, and a year is a short period of time in publishing. So yeah.
Yeah, time is bizarre in publishing.
It really is. Sure. It's fast and slow, and it's increasingly, like I always say, publishing is basically just a bunch of increasingly intense periods of waiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that never stops.
And it never stops ever.
Yeah, and it's really wild for me because I live in Sri Lanka, and the time difference is like we're about half a day ahead of the US. So I get all my exciting emails and things through the night. So I've gotten into this really bad habit of like waking up in the middle of the night and checking my phone because I'm, you know, hoping for news and things like that. And I need to, you know, especially this last month has been so exciting that I've just, my sleep cycle is completely whacked now. Oh, I need to get it back on track.
Yeah, I'm bad about that. And I'm only like an hour off from New York, so I can imagine.
Right.
Well, we have a few minutes left, so I have to ask you, please tell us about your very spoiled huskies. Oh. We are dog and cat people here, and I want to know all about them.
Oh, they are just, so I've had to like lock myself in this room now because Hector, my bigger one, he stands on his hind legs and he can like open door handles.
Oh no.
Yeah, so he gets really upset when he's not been given too much attention. They're both incredibly spoiled. Like they, you know, if they're not walked exactly when they need to be walked, and if they're not fed exactly when they need to be fed, and they're not given belly rubs exactly when they need them, especially Hector, the older, bigger one, he does this thing where he likes, I call it, he sings the song of his people, where he just sits down and he howls and howls and howls. they're the best. I honestly don't know how we would have gotten through like lockdown and the pandemic without them. You know, I mean, they literally, very literally got us out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, I'm really not sure how people who don't have pets have gotten through the last year and a half.
I don't know. I have a dog too. And like, if I don't have a dog, I wouldn't have gone outside for months. Yeah. It just forces you to get up and go out and like smell fresh air and just be in the world for sure.
Yeah, it's so important. And I think it's really nice to have that like driving force, I guess. And I mean, I have to admit, like the unconditional love is pretty awesome. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dogs are great. I love huskies too, because they're often like kind of talkative, right? Mm-hmm. Like they'll like sing and howl and like yes. make little noises. I know there's a lot of really cute YouTube videos of huskies doing that that I enjoy. So.
Yeah. It's wild. And what's really interesting is that, so there are two of them. It's Hector's the older one, and there's Harley. And they have such different personalities. Hector is this big, like lazy lump who just wants to sit there and eat everything. And Harley's like this little adventurer who totally bosses Hector around. And she's a lot smaller than him as well. But she will like bully him. She will boss him around. She's very much like an alpha female. And
love it.
And it's ridiculous. She recently got in a tussle with a porcupine that had made its way in. And it was so scary for me and my husband. Because she got a quill sort of going through her eyelid, and we thought she would have lost an eye. It was so scary. But we like managed to slowly like pull this quill out, and she was totally fine. She was trying to go back outside and like show that porcupine who's boss. She just did not care. She's a little warrior, that one.
Aww. Oh, that's so cute. Well, thank you so much for being here. This has been a fabulous conversation. So do you want to tell people where they can find you on the internet, your social media handles and such?
Mm-hmm. So my website, everything is pretty easy. It's all my name. So my website is amandajayathissa.com. On Instagram and Twitter, it's just at amandajayathissa. And on Facebook as well, it's just like /amandajayathissa. My pre-order links for everything for I think most of the stores are on my website, but you can find copies of My Sweet Girl wherever books are sold.
And I assume you can find pictures of these adorable huskies on your Instagram account, right?
Oh yeah, they are very much the stars. I mean, like the last few weeks have been mostly book news, but I occasionally get messages from people like, why haven't you uploaded a photo of your dogs recently?
Just put the books next to the dog. It's fine.
Yeah, no, I'm like,
that's the best marketing.
Oh yeah, I've totally used them for that. I'm like, hey, sit still. I'm going to take like, and now they're kind of fed up of it. Like if they see me approaching them with a copy of my book, they run away. So kind of
I love that. Aww.
They're like, no, not this again.
Thank you so much, and I hope you have a great release day. I know it's like late in the day there, so you'll probably be up late tonight, but congratulations on the release of the book, and people are gonna love this one. It's so fun and twisty, and it's gonna cause a lot of conversation, I think.
Yes, definitely.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me on the show. This was so much fun.
That's it for this episode of Unlikable Female Characters. Don't forget to subscribe, and you can also follow us on Twitter at UnlikableFCPod for updates, book recommendations and angry feminist rants. Our website is unlikablefemalecharacters.com, and we're also on Instagram at unlikablefemalecharacters. Thanks for listening.